Today's Teisho will be on case 25 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 25 is entitled Kyozan's Dream. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led in to sit in the third seat. A senior monk struck with a gavel and said, "Today the one in the third seat will speak." Kyozan rose and, striking with the gavel, said, "The truth of the Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Tai Cho, hear the truth." Umon's comment, "Now tell me, did Kyozan preach or did he not? If he opens his mouth, he is lost. If he seals his mouth, he is lost. Even if he neither opens nor shuts his mouth, he is 108,000 miles away from the truth." Mumon's verse, "In broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. He makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd." Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. I was driving last week back from the Sunday sit, which we have in Stanhope, and there was a program on the radio, NPR, and a woman was talking about how young people in America are so dependent on their electronic devices. She is actually quite young herself, so this is sort of her generation. And she was talking about her friends. Excuse me. She was talking about her friends and how dependent they are. And indeed, you know, I can see that all over the campus. You know, I teach here at Rutgers, and I will walk outside of our building, Murray Hall, and I'll see people sitting on the benches or sitting under the beautiful old elm trees, and their faces are directed downward towards these little screens. It's surprising to me, as someone who didn't grow up in that world. You know, when I walk out of the building, you know, the thing that struck me this week was just how beautiful the weather was. You know, this week was a really unusual late summer weather for New Jersey, because the humidity was almost zero, and it was in the 50s or low 60s in the mornings. So, you know, I would be in my office grading papers or talking to students, and I walked out, and the first thing I would see is that incredible blue sky, and then there are these old elm trees in front of our building, and they're really beautiful. And then there is this green grass, and on the green grass are students, and their faces are buried in these little screens, and their little fingers are tapping away. So for me, as an old codger, you know, this is disturbing, you know, or at least it's puzzling. Right? But this woman, who's a contemporary of my students almost, just a little older, was saying that she has sort of had to go through a process of changing her way of being in the world, you could say. And that's a philosopher's term, but you know, she herself has constant connection to her devices, and she began to make a project out of noticing when she and other people she knows turn to their devices. And she talked about going like to the motor vehicles centers and waiting in line to get her license renewed. And there are all these young people. And as soon as they get into line, they start in on their iPads or iPods or iPhones or other devices. They're black. I guess people still have Blackberries. Androids and so on. And she said what this does is when young people are in an environment they feel alien or uncertain, they whip out their electronic devices and they lose themselves in that world. And it makes the other world, the one that's causing them anxiety, to disappear, right, for a while. So it's like going down a rabbit hole, you know, basically. You're in the motor. Nobody likes to go to the motor vehicles centers, right? It very boring places, remarkably ugly and inhospitable, generally speaking. And she's waiting in line, and it pulls out the device, and then all of that disappears, and she goes into this virtual world where she feels reassured. And she talked about other experiences she has where she turns to her phone when she's feeling lost or when she's feeling exposed or vulnerable. And this really resonated with me. In my class, you know, when on the first day of school, all my students, almost all of them, had their phones out. Their devices out when I came into the room. And they're all busily pecking away at the screens. And I said, you know, in this class, this is a screen-free zone. So I'm going to ask you to put your phones away. And so many of them just put the phones down. They didn't put them away. They put them on the table, right? And I said, please put them away, away, you know. And I pointed to their purses or their bags. And with trembling hands, they put them away. Thursday, I had a class, though, and I had to ask three people to put them away, right? You know, so there's obviously a powerful counterforce, right, that has many of the qualities of an addiction. It just does. It strikes me as addictive, right? This is addictive behavior where the teacher says, please put that away, and you can't bring yourself to put it away. And I think this woman, I didn't catch her name on the radio, is right. You know, coming into a new class, it is a difficult situation, right? I mean, we've done it a lot, so we're used to it. But it's actually quite difficult. You know, you walk into a room full of perfect strangers, and this teacher comes in, and you know, if it's the course I teach, you know it's going to be a hard course, and you know you're going to have to work, and you're also there in a way to compete with all those other people. So as an environment, it's not as welcoming as it seems, and consciously, you know, consciously, we know it's quote-unquote just a classroom. But all this stuff is under the surface, right? You're anxious about the teacher. Will the teacher be disciplinarian, remote, or will the teacher be friendly and supportive? You don't know. The teacher walks in the door, you don't know that person. You don't know about your classmates. You know, they'll probably be okay, but you don't know. So there's this big uncertainty when you walk into a classroom. You don't know if you're going to leave that classroom with the grade you want, the A, or the grade you didn't want, the C. You know, all of that's uncertain. And so what do? You pull out your phone. You know, you start pecking away at your screen, and you enter this virtual world. You go down the rabbit hole, and everything around you disappears. So she was saying she's trying to wean herself from her phone. She's trying to get away from the phone and actually be in that uncertainty. Because you know, she correctly understands that that is one of the most interesting things about life, right? Is being in a situation where you can't control the outcome and you don't know the parameters. So she said she's actually started to go on trips in her car without her GPS. And she said, I use paper maps. Imagine that. And she said, sometimes I get lost, but she said, I'm really getting into the experience of sort of flying by the seat of my pants. So, you know, I thought that was really a wonderful, I thought she had a lot of insight, and I hoped thousands and thousands of people heard that broadcast. Because it seems to me that our predicament is very much like the one she's talking about, even though we don't notice it. You know, we may or we may not use electronic devices, but we definitely create an artificial world. You know, everything we do is a kind of ritual. Right? Everything we do has a character of a kind of ritual. So, you know, it's really not necessary that people get to their offices and say, if everybody where you work gets to the office at 8:30 and leaves at 5:30, it's really not necessary that this be the case. It's not. You know, you could start your office at 9:30 or 10, even 10:30, you know. You could start working then. You know, the 8:30 mark or the 9 o'clock mark, whatever it is where you work, is really arbitrary. You know, in my office, there's a woman who works in our office who can't stay late in the day because she has childcare issues. So she gets to the office at 8 o'clock, and she gets to leave at 4, so she can put in her hours and leave. Now, there's nobody in the office at 8 o'clock, and no students come by. Classes start at 8:10. So, you know, she's in her office and she's doing some work for our office. But it's an arbitrary decision for us to allow her to come in at 8 and leave at I guess she leaves at 4. You know. So, you know, this whole idea, you know, if you get up in the morning and you go outside your house, if your neighborhood is like mine, at around 8 o'clock, these streets, which are not very busy normally, they're full of cars. And everybody's racing to work, right? And people are honking, you know, you get into these lines. I myself get into these, you know, terrible lines. There's a train that stops traffic, and you sit there and you look at your watch, and you look at your watch, and you've got to get to your office. Now, all of this is kind of like, this is just symbolic, right? All of this is, there's no natural reason we have to get to work at 8 o'clock or 8:30 or 9 o'clock. It's just conventional. Actually, many things we do are like this. You know, my nephew, in a couple of weeks, is going to get married. He's getting married, and they've gone through this whole ritual, which is news to me. You know, when I and my wife got married, we were already living together, and we said, maybe we should get married. And we said, okay, let's get married. So then we flew out to Albuquerque, where my wife's family is, and we had the wedding in their backyard, and they invited all their friends over. All their friends came into the backyard, and we had a justice of the peace come, and we signed a piece of paper, and we were done. And my nephew, it's a very different story. You know, it's very elaborate. I hate to think how expensive this is going to be. But apparently they have chosen, there's something called a bridal registry. I didn't know about this. But the couple picks out all the gifts they'd like to get. And so you don't go, like, you don't spontaneously go and say, oh, this would be a great plate to give them. Or, you go to the bridal registry and there's all these products they've already picked. And this is all news to me. I had no idea. You know, so you go online and you can see, and it says this, I can't remember the phrasing, but it's this gift is already fulfilled. Yeah, it's like a wish fulfilled. This gift is already fulfilled. And there's pages of this stuff, you know. So, I was just I have to tell you, I was really appalled. I was appalled. It's like, what the hell? You know, when we had our wedding, you know, as I say, it was a very informal affair. My wife's sister is a sculptor and a painter, and she was working for a bakery in town as a cake decorator. And she did our cake, and it was magnificent, right? And my wife is quite a talented artist, and she actually made a block, a linoleum block print invitations. So it was like a homemade wedding. You know, this is the style. Our sashines are like homemade sashines, you know. This was a homemade wedding. And people came, and we had this ceremony, and afternoon it was over. And I remember one of my father-in-law's name was Jack. And Jack was a design engineer and kind of a bohemian. He was an artist who worked for Sandia Labs, and I don't think he ever wore a suit in his life. And I, after the ceremony was over, I heard one of his friends come up and say, "Jack, I'm so proud of you. You put your drink down and everything." During the ceremony. So it was that kind of a place. It was great. It was so simple. It was so wonderful. You know, so we just, do you want to get married? Yes, let's get married. We got married. We flew out to Albuquerque. We got married. It took an afternoon. It probably took less than $500 for the whole thing, you know. So my nephew, you know, there's the bridal registry. We pick out all these products, and this product has been fulfilled. And you know, we're pouring through this, and there's no way for us to make like a personal statement, right? You know, so it would be nice to give them something that they would remember us by. But I don't think, you know, every time they use the coffee maker, they'll think, "Oh, this is the coffee maker that Kurt and Barbara gave us." I don't think so, right? I don't think it's going to be like that, right? So, you know, there's all this anonymous stuff they're getting. And anyway, I just have the feeling this is going to be a very different experience than the one Barbara and I had. It doesn't have to be like that. But, you know, I do know they're under so much pressure to get it right. You know, they've spent so many hours picking all this out. My nephew's future wife has, you know, gone to great lengths to make sure that her bridesmaids are all going to be coordinated, color coordinated. And they've spent a lot of money on their outfits. Again, you know, my wife's wedding dress was made by her mother-in-law and her sister, you know. So it's simple dress, very attractive, very nice, you know. This is a big deal. This is a big production. And I can already see there's a lot of tension. You know, like I talked to my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, on the phone, and you could hear the tension in her voice as this event is coming up. You know, and people lose track of, they forget that this is a game. This is a game. You know, it becomes incredibly real, and it becomes, produces a huge amount of tension, right? You can just, tension is in the air. You know? So, you know, things are going to go wrong. You know, the flowers are going to be the wrong flowers, and you know, the wrong flowers will come, and it's possible, you know, the bride or my sister-in-law will absolutely melt down. They're not the right flowers. You know, this is a human thing, right? We create this world that we call real, but it's actually just like a play. It's pretend. And at first, you know, when we're growing up, we learn how to play the parts that are available in the play, you know. So, you know, when you're growing up, you, if you are a little kid and you go to a wedding, you don't experience that tension. It's all just, it could actually be fun, right? There's no pressure. You know, you're just there observing. You don't understand half of what's going on. And part of growing up is becoming socialized into the collective dream, right? Where you realize this is important. This must be done right. You know, So, at some weddings you've seen they have little kids carry the bride's train. You know, they have like a little girl or little boy and girl walk up and throw flower petals out or something on the ground. And it's so cute because they're dressed like little adults, right? And we're enjoying their lack of understanding in a way, right? They're going through the motions they don't quite understand. And it's funny and it's actually endearing because they aren't yet in the dream, right? They're not yet fully in the dream. When you're fully in the dream, you know, it becomes incredibly real. It's like we're like actors who forget that we're playing a part, you know. And when you forget you're playing a part, you know, one of the things that happens is there's this tremendous tension. Tension to do it right, to do it right. So, you know, I think a lot of growing up is moving from seeing that it's not real to becoming enclosed in this dream, this collective fantasy. And you don't need technology to do it, right? Although I think the technology has taken it to another level. You know, it's taking it to an even higher level. But I think when we're uncertain about things, we try to ground ourselves. You don't have to have an iPad or an iPod, but we try to ground ourselves in the script. You know, we try to go back to the script. What should I be doing, right? Even if this isn't particularly effective. So, you know, I'm a teacher, and when I started teaching, I didn't know how to be a teacher at all. So, you know, I would go into classrooms and feel like a terrible imposter, really. I would feel like if they only knew that I don't have any idea what I'm doing, you know. But it was true. You know, when you're an apprentice teacher, you know, you walk into a classroom, you have no idea what you're doing. And people ask you questions that you can't answer, and you're supposed to respond with authority, right? And sometimes you fake it, or you spew out a bunch of stuff that doesn't really make any sense, and you hope the questioner will move on and let you go. You know? So learning how to be a teacher at first is like just winging it, playing a role you don't fully understand. And usually when people are in that situation, they try to model themselves on the expert teachers they've had. You know, so you think back about, you know, I might think about Professor Cox. Gary Cox was one of my teachers. And you know, what would Gary say? What would Gary do, right? I sort of tried to be Gary in front of the classroom. How would Gary handle this? I got to be more self-assured, and then I began to really plan my classes out. You know, so I would really be meticulous with my class plans. I knew exactly what I was going to do every class. You know, and I knew what I was going to say. You know, sometimes I would even have like lecture notes. And I knew what I was going to say. I was going to put the joke in here. I was going to do this, and I was going to do that. Anybody who tries to teach that way is in for frustration in various ways, you know. I mean, one problem is that you can plan out your class, but you're dealing with real human beings, you know. And real human beings are sort of impossible to scope out in advance. So I remember I brought this essay in. We were reading this essay by a very famous a British novelist named D.H. Lawrence. And I had been to New Mexico, which is this beautiful place, and D.H. Lawrence lived in New Mexico, and he wrote this essay, which I really consider a masterpiece, and it's called My World in New Mexico, or something like that. And it's about how going to from England to New Mexico totally transformed his worldview. So I gave it to my students thinking this is going to blow them away. You know, this is going to blow them away. And I had it all planned out. I had the whole lesson, you know. I came to class and I said, wasn't that great? Silence. And then I began to ask questions, and it became clear to me my students really didn't like the reading. They really hated this essay. I mean, it was like they hated it. And I kept trying to plow through the class, you know, like, that can't be happening, right? You know? And I remember actually being really upset, really mad at my students because they didn't appreciate what was so great about this essay. I was really like angry. By the end of the class, you know, I didn't do it, but I felt like throwing an eraser at my students. And by the way, I have actually heard of colleagues doing that. There was a man in my department named George Kearns, who one of the reasons he was forced to retire was that he was throwing chalk at his students. But I understand it, you know, I understand, you know. You know, so you can't throw chalk at your students. That's not a good teaching strategy, not a good pedagogy. That's called pedagogy. That's not good pedagogy. But I felt like throwing the eraser, blackboard eraser at my students. And you know, what had happened was I came in there with a script, right? And I expected certain responses. And as my students were moving in a different direction, I kept trying to pull the class back to the plan, the script. And they were resisting me, you know, they were. They didn't want to, they didn't agree. And so, you know, the class became very, very tense because I had this image in my mind of how it was supposed to go. I was supposed to come in and say, what did you think? And I'd go, oh, this is a life-transforming essay. Thank you, professor. Thank you, you know. It didn't go like that, you know. It was like this fight, turned into like a fight with my students. And at the end of the class, I think everybody had a bitter taste. So, you know, I've had my share of classes like that, where, you know, you come in and you have a plan, and the human dynamics of the classroom sort of subvert your plan. And pretty soon, you're in a place that isn't in your lecture notes. It isn't on your class plan, you know. And then what are you going to do? And there's another problem with having a class plan every time, lesson plan every time. You know, it doesn't allow you to be responsive to your students. See, so you can't really be awake or alert to what's happening because you're trying to get back to the plan. And even if the plan works, you know, you're going to find that your teaching becomes less and less exciting to you. Less and less exciting. You know, I remember there was another guy in my department. His name was Bill Fisher. And he's long gone. But he was like 76, and they finally forced him to retire. And he wasn't throwing chalk at his students. But he was giving the same lectures year after year that he had. And believe it or not, I was on the committee. It was my unfortunate job to be on this committee to review him. And, you know, he had lecture notes that were like mimeographs. You know, this is from long, long ago. This is like an ancient technology. You know, if it had been papyrus, it wouldn't be much. You know, it was old. So, you know, we had to nudge him out. We had to say, Bill, you know, you've done a fantastic job. We gave a party for him. But he had to go, you know, it's time. So, you know, but I think to myself, he must have been so bored. He must have been on autopilot all the time. You know, it's like, okay, it's Tuesday in November. This is the lecture on Milton. Here's my lecture. Any questions? You know. So, you know, I think if you have the confidence, if you've taught enough, you can assign a reading and you can give students things they can, you can ask them questions and just see where it goes. You know, you get to be a skillful questioner. You get to be a skillful conversationalist, right? And you can sort of steer the conversation, but you need to be open to what the students are going to say. And if you can do that, if you have that kind of like a confidence or trust in the process, you know, just trusting in the process, all kinds of wonderful things can happen. But if you're too locked down into a plan, like too locked down in a plan, you can't be alert to what's actually unfolding. See? So, you know, it's very helpful not to have a plan when you walk into a classroom. It really is. You can have some goals, or you could just think about the classroom as an occasion to discuss something, and you don't know where it's going to go. And the interesting thing about teaching that way is that at the end of the class, you may find yourself taking notes on the conversation because you've learned something. So this idea of how to be in the moment, you know, without a plan, and being open to what's happening or responsive to what's happening, is I think was a real breakthrough for me when I realized I don't have to cover everything, I don't have to make sure my students understand every last word, you know. I'm going to see what they don't know, what interests them, and I'm going to take it from there and wing it. You know, this has actually made me a very successful teacher. You know, I always get really great evaluations from my students because, you know, I fly by the seat of my pants most of the time. And at first I felt guilty about this. You know, I felt guilty because I wasn't in control. But, you know, my students learn a lot, and they actually give me compliments on my teaching. They say, I learned a lot from this course. So I think letting go and trusting the process has really paid off in my teaching. And, you know, I think that this approach is not just about teaching, but, you know, about many different things. You know, how we, when my wife and I, we lived together for about a year or 2 years, really, before we decided to get married. And living together was great, because living together means hardly anything. It means you're living in the same apartment, right? And we did agree not to have relations with other people. You know, we were committed to being together. But, you know, there weren't any expectations. You know, it was just like, let's invent a relationship. You know, let's invent our relationship. You know, when we got married, there was a period there where it became oppressive, really. You know, I suddenly felt like I have to be the husband. You know, I have to be the husband. I can't fool around anymore. I can't have any more fun, you know. I have to be the husband. You know, and we began to fall into these behaviors that we had seen our parents do. You know, it wasn't like I was trying to give my wife orders or something, which would not have worked, you know. But it was just, I had this suddenly this sense that I should go out and buy some of the shoes my father used to wear, you know, that you have to shine up, you know, Hickey Freeman shoes or something, and a suit somehow, you know, and be like my dad, you know. And that was very oppressive, you know, actually. When I realized, you know, we don't have to be in a quote-unquote marriage. You know, we can continue to invent our relationship. We were so much happier. We both sort of realized, you know, we're making ourselves sick. Why are we doing this, you know? Let's just go back to the way it was, you know? We don't have to be anything in particular. We can invent our relationship. And we've been married for 40 years, or almost 40 years, so it's that strategy has really paid off. We create this world, which is, you know, just a collective dream. You know, a marriage is a dream. It's a dream. You know, people could live together in many different relationships. You know, you could have more than one wife. There are cultures on earth that have where men have multiple wives. There are cultures on earth where women have multiple husbands. it's not, they're not very happy, but there are such places, you know. Imagine if you have to, you know, if you're married to a man, imagine having more than one. It would be just an incredible headache, I think. So, you could arrange people having relationships in many different ways. You know, Western people have one man and one woman living in their own place. You know, most people don't live with their parents. Most people don't live with, you know, it's not a multi-generational house. All over the world, multi-generational families are quite common. You know, in Seattle, there would be a lot of people from East Asia who would buy these gigantic houses, and several generations would move into the house together. You know, so you can arrange things lots of different ways. Not one of them is really like the right way. And I think our tendency is we're uncertain or afraid. We want to go back to the script. It's like a new teacher. You know, you're standing in front of the class, and you have, when the students begin to do something you're not prepared for, you keep trying to get back to the lesson plan. But what you ought to do is get rid of the lesson plan, see? And see what's happening. Respond to what's happening. We don't always have that confidence. But I think Zen is very much about this. You know, there is a kind of emergent orderliness to things. There is. You know, there's an emergent sort of like order in things that is constantly, you know, things are changing, but they're not chaos. You know, chaos is a human judgment based upon not being observant. There are patterns to everything. There's an order to everything. It's emerging. It's always changing, but it's always present. You know, and our perception that things are falling apart or descending into chaos is an illusion caused by our having too many expectations. See? So, you know, a lot of meditation is learning how to live this way. Live this way. You know, part of sitting on the cushion is breaking with. You know, you need to be disciplined. Let me just say, if you don't practice Zen regularly, nothing is going to happen. And, you know, I get up every morning and I do Zazen, and I'm very predictable and routine. But what happens on the cushion is always open. You know, and if I have expectations, there's always going to be tension and frustration. Same thing with Sesshin. You know, Sesshin is highly structured. But if you're really practicing Zen, no two sesshins are the same. Different things are happening all the time. So you do need a kind of structure. If you're a teacher, you need a class. People need to show up at 8:10. You need to take attendance. You need to penalize. The teacher in me says, you have to penalize people if they're 15 minutes late. You have to do it. They have to come to class. But then, you know, you can open yourself up to what's happening. And Zazen is like that. You know, you sit down on the cushion. If you come in to meditate and you have expectations, right, that's going to create a lot of tension and a lot of unhappiness even. You know, so I will ask people, how was your sit? You know, I'll go around and say, how was your sit? And every once in a while, you know, there's a woman who comes in the evening. She, 2 weeks ago, I said, how was your sit? And her face was beaming. It was like the sun came out, you know. She said, that was wonderful, right? So then I saw her this last week. How was your sit? And she, you know, face wasn't beaming, you know. Something else was happening. And my feeling is, you know, she was waiting for that experience that had happened a few weeks ago. So she's trying to repeat something that happened. She's made a script out of it. This is what we do, right? She's made a script out of it, and now when reality isn't following the script, she feels deprived. She feels like she's failing. She feels like she's missing the mark. This is so human. So a lot of Zen training is learning how to be present with the unfolding order and to be awake to this and not impose our structures on things, right? We all do it. You know, I'm sure you know that baseball players are notoriously superstitious. So, you know, if you hit a home run, a typical baseball player will rehearse everything he did up to hitting that ball. You know, so, and the next time he walks to the plate, he'll do the same thing. He'll tap his cleats with his bat. He'll spit to the left, right? You know, this is famous. This is superstitious behavior, but it's so human. People do it all the time, you know. Even writers do this, right? You know, they work up a little ritual. You know, I got this thing published. Here's what I did. Maybe I'll do exactly that same thing. This is so human, right? But creating a script like this makes us less intelligent about what's happening. So a lot of Zen practice is learning how to have a structure like a class, but get rid of the script. If you don't come to the students don't come to class and the teacher doesn't come to class, nothing happens. So if you don't practice regularly, you know, nothing is going to happen. But when you sit down on the cushion, you have to be open to what's unfolding. And that takes a lot of practice, believe it or not. And it takes even more practice to do that off the cushion. See? I mean, last night, a couple people came to sit who hadn't been sitting in a long time. They had been away while we were having our sesshin, and then they didn't come back until now, so that's like a month. And I asked one of the people, I said, well, you know, how was your sit? He said, oh, I'm so glad to be back. And I said, well, where were you? And he said, well, you know, he said, after sesshin, I got out of the rhythm. And I said, well, did you practice on your own? He said, no, I didn't. I don't know why. You know, I finally came back. You know, that is really, people dismiss as trivial things that are really very important. You know, this guy had been practicing meditation for more than a year. He'd been coming here every Friday night. And then, you know, he disappeared for about a month and he came back. And he said, I'm so glad I'm back. Why didn't he practice on his own? See? And people think meditation is just about coming in, sitting down on the cushion, watching your breath and blissing out. Or not, and then that's a bummer, right? I don't know if people still say bummer, but that's a disappointment. See, if meditation were just about coming in, sitting on the cushion, and blissing out, this would be a drug. It wouldn't do anybody any good. And I actually think thousands of Americans think that's what meditation is about. I really do. I think meditation has been sold to people as this opportunity to, you know, get rid of your stress and be able to go on with your life. And that would not be good for people. You know, just getting rid of your stress doesn't go to the cause of your stress. It doesn't change your mental habits. It doesn't change the way you interact with things, right? If you don't change those things, getting rid of stress is not your friend, actually. It could be hurting you in many ways, right? So meditation isn't just about getting rid of stress or sitting down on the cushion and blissing out. And your unconscious mind knows this, right? That's why it doesn't want to sit down on the cushion sometimes. You know, to sit down on the cushion takes a great deal of courage, believe it or not. It's not trivial. We think it's trivial. You know, we think, oh, well, I just didn't sit. I don't know why. I'm too busy, right? Oh, I'm too busy. You know, something else I heard on the radio going to work yesterday, and this was amazing to me, but I knew this. The average American watches 5 hours of television a day. I'm not kidding you. You can Google it yourself. It's true. It's like, when do they eat? When do they sleep? Do they work? You know, but you know, people watch TV before they go to work. Apparently, they watch TV like 4 hours at night. They finish dinner, and then it's like you put in a solid block of, you know. And yet, people can't meditate. Oh, I'm too busy to meditate. It's like, what is that about? That's, people are not necessarily. I'm not scolding anybody. I'm just saying. I'm not scolding anybody. I didn't scold him. You know, but it is psychologically interesting, isn't it, that people want to do something, but they can't sit down and do it. And the reason is that meditation takes a lot of courage. It's not just about sitting down and getting rid of your stress. When you sit down on a cushion, you're facing your true nature. Doing zazen is like looking in a mirror and seeing your flaws. It's like looking in a mirror and seeing your obstacles, your fear, your anger. You see, this is difficult, right? This is hard. You know, seeing your impatience, seeing your worry. Right? So sitting on a cushion is not easy. It takes a structure. You know, it actually helps to have other people sitting on the cushion. It's like, okay, I can go in there. I can unpack this because there's a structure. I'm not alone, right? I can do this. Yeah. So a big part of meditation is actually facing our obstacles. Facing our obstacles and working through those obstacles. And consciously we say to ourselves, let me just cut through my stress. But your unconscious mind is saying, uh-oh, there's something in here. Something in here. See? So, you know, sitting on the cushion is really consequential. It's actually difficult to do and it takes great courage. And part of what takes great courage is learning how to be, trust the process. Trust the process. You know, doing meditation is like opening a door, and inside this closet are all kinds of skeletons, all kinds of things, you know. There was a person who's been sitting here regularly, and she's been sitting for a year. And I said, and sometimes she has had really wonderful sits where she's been very blissy and it's been great. And then I said to her, how is your sit? And she said, my leg still goes to sleep. I've been doing this for a year and my leg still goes to sleep. And I said, well, that's okay. You know, what's wrong with that? You know, so what? You know, stretch your leg out. You know, you're just depressing some nerves in your leg. I said, I swear to you, I've been doing this for 40 years. It won't hurt you, you know. I think this bothered her. The fact that this bothered her so much has to do with, like, frankly, her own personality, right? And she wants to be able to come in, sit perfectly on the cushion, and have no numbness in her legs. And I made a joke which didn't work. I said, well, it'll probably only last for the first 10 years. So I don't think she didn't laugh, you know. But the thing is, you know, so what? If it's not a perfect sit. So what if your leg goes to sleep? I swear to you, you're not hurting yourself. I swear it. You know, I have perfect blood pressure. You know, I go in, I have 110 over like 65, 70. You know, that's because of meditation, honestly. You won't be hurt by this. But it has to do with being attached to a kind of perfection. I want this to be perfect. I want to be the perfect Zen student. And it's like, let go. So what if your leg goes to sleep? You know, nobody's judging you. You know, it's not a crime. There was a very famous Zen master who, this is the kind of story that gets Zen people into trouble. But there was a very famous Zen master whose leg was deformed. And he could never get in the right posture. And just before he died, he pulled his legs up, and he took his leg, he broke his leg. And he pulled it into the right posture. And I think he died then or something. But he said, I wish I'd done that before, you know. Please don't do that. But, you know, what are you worried about? You know, what are you worried about? I might lose my job. But, you know, people lose their job every day, and they go on, you know. The worst thing in the world happens, and then you realize this isn't the worst thing in the world. Still alive, you know. I know somebody who recently lost his job, and he was totally miserable in his job. And when he lost his job, he was horrified because he lost his job. He had an abusive boss. He was being exploited. And he got a new job, and he said he's making almost twice what he made. And his boss is not as abusive, totally not abusive, but not as abusive, right? And he's much happier, you know. And he never would have quit his job and gone out and looked for a better job. You know, change is difficult, but, you know, I think he was able to respond to the crisis creatively because it didn't overwhelm him. He didn't sit at home paralyzed with anxiety. He got out and he went on interviews, and he has many talents, you know. And somebody took note of that and gave him this new job, which is actually the kind of job he was looking for. So the worst thing we can do when things aren't going right is to try to go back to the script. This is like Zen 101. You know, that usually fails. So one of the things we learn on the cushion is if it's not going the way we plan, then we have to change our plan. Change plan. You know, I've said this before, but you know, the art of Zen is like, you know, instead of aiming your arrows at a target and trying to hit a bullseye, you shoot your arrow into the air, and wherever it lands, you paint a bullseye around it. But that is how to live creatively, right? What is happening now? And you can only ask that question if you've learned to trust. But Zen is all about learning to trust. In a dream, Kyozan Osho, Osho means priest, went to Maitreya's palace and was led in to sit in the third seat. Maitreya is the future Buddha, the Buddha who's coming. Maitreya is the Buddha of the future. The future is always coming. If you trust in the process, you know that Maitreya is coming. Maitreya is the future Buddha. The future Buddha is the Buddha of loving kindness. See? So this Buddha is going to bring loving kindness to you. And the future is going to bring loving kindness. You see the symbolism of this. Maitreya is the trust. Maitreya is the one who says, trust me. It's going to work out. In a dream, Kyozan Osho went to Maitreya's palace and was led in to sit in the third seat. A senior monk struck the gavel and said, today the one in the third seat will speak. Kyozan rose and striking with the gavel, he said, the truth of the great way is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. So he says there's no map, there's no chart, there's no plan. He says, hear the truth. Mumon's comment. Now tell me, did Kyozan preach or did he not? If he opens his mouth, he's lost. If he shuts his mouth, he's lost. Even if he neither opens nor shuts his mouth, he is 108,000 miles away from the truth. See, now that is such a funny joke. Because in Buddhism, 108 is the number of perfection. See? So the message is, you think you're 108,000 miles from it, but being 108,000 miles from it is just where you should be. It's perfection itself. Mumon's verse, in the broad daylight, under the blue sky, he forges a dream in a dream. That's what we do. We humans live in a world of dreams. That's what it means to be a human. He makes up a monstrous story and tries to deceive the whole crowd. In other words, he tells people it's a dream. Some people will be terrified, and some people will be set free.